Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We begin today with our Friday Ask the Mayor segment. Well, no, not quite. It's a Friday Ask the Former Mayor segment, my questions and yours, for Bill de Blasio, his first appearance here since leaving office, and a little like old times, as he did come on every Friday for most of his mayoralty, as many of you remember. The reason we invited him back for today is that he has an article in The Atlantic on mistakes he believes he made as mayor that he wants Joe Biden to avoid as president, especially to help Democrats retain their congressional majorities in the midterm elections. So we'll talk some about New York City in the post de Blasio era as well, but mostly national politics here. And good morning, Mr. Mayor. Feels like old times. Welcome back to WNYC.
I feel young again, Brian. It's good to be with you. And I think back fondly to our dialogue over many years. So thanks for having me.
We human beings are funny creatures, you know. We can get nostalgic for something we consider the good old days when it wasn't even 5 months ago. Aren't we funny creatures?
We are very funny creatures, although I'll tell you, it feels really, really different just humanly. And this is something I've been reflecting on a lot. You know, they used to call, I think it was back in the 60s, that someone coined the phrase that mayor of New York City is the second toughest job in America.
Yeah.
And when you're in the middle of it, it is just a blur how intense it is, how fast, how never ending. And to actually sort of get back to life, you know, to family, friends, normalcy, it feels like a long time ago on one level. And I feel an empathy for my successor, because it's nonstop in a way that I don't think any other experience I've ever had in my life even comes close.
Well, we'll come back around as we go to some observations you may have about what your successor, Eric Adams, is dealing with. But I do want to get to the premise of your article, which is more nationally angled and something that maybe you wouldn't have wanted to say out loud when you were coming on here on Fridays when you were in office. You wrote, "When it comes to being unpopular, I'm unfortunately somewhat of an expert." Why did you write those words?
Well, Brian, I had time to think. And, you know, the piece, I did an op-ed for The Atlantic that really was motivated by feeling an empathy for what Joe Biden's been going through, and a sense that I saw things that could be changed, mistakes that could be fixed that I thought would really help him and help the Democratic Party. And I felt it deeply. I saw sort of this pattern. And I didn't want to say, "Hey, Joe Biden, fix your problems." I wanted to say, "I'm going to acknowledge my own problems in a job that, you know, pales in comparison to the presidency, but does at least have some parallels to the intensity of the presidency." And just say, I realize I got lost in the weeds. One of the phrases I put in the op-ed really typifies it to me. I mistook policy for popularity. And I think Joe Biden, a lot of the times, is working on a wonderful policy. I think he's done extraordinary things in building an international coalition for Ukraine, for example. But the people don't see that work. It's behind the scenes. And the people are dealing with kitchen table issues, really painful issues now, COVID and inflation and so much fear. Joe Biden needs to speak to them and come back to them and speak to them, as it were, at their kitchen table, in some ways, as FDR did famously with the fireside chats, and focus much more on helping people understand where he's taking us. And I don't think I did that well enough in the last years in particular as mayor. And that's why I wanted to write the piece, to say I fell into this trap. I don't think you have to, Mr. President. I think there's still time to turn that around.
In the case of yourself, you seem to say that you did give the city a clear sense of where you were taking them in your first term, less so in your second term. In the case of Biden, do you think he gave the country a clear sense of where he's taking us early on, but has stopped doing so?
I think that let's put it into sort of three phases. The election was such an extraordinary contrast, Biden and Trump. that I don't even think it was so much about vision. It was about the contrast of two very different philosophies and, human beings. The early months of the administration dominated by fighting back COVID, I think that's when there was a tremendous sense of direction because there were immediate missions to be accomplished. I think he did an outstanding job on stimulus, on vaccination, obviously later on infrastructure. But I think the third phase has been when the energy and momentum of that initial surge was over and we confronted a new set of problems, obviously particularly inflation, but a lot of other uncertainty beyond inflation. I think it was time for the president to double down on a broader vision of where America could go and where America would go eventually and how his approaches would take us there. But I think what happened conversely, and it's a variation of what happened to me, is he kind of got pulled into the Washington day-to-day battles, the disappointments with Build Back Better, et cetera. And the conversation got insular, it got internal, it much, much less about relating back to what people were going through. And it got defensive. This is another mistake I feel I made often when I felt I was doing meaningful work and I was getting a lot of criticism rather than saying, okay, well, some of that must be I'm not articulating my work well enough, or maybe I'm not focusing on the right priorities. I would get very defensive. I think it's human and natural, but I don't, forgive it in myself. I think Biden falls into that kind of defensive speech quite easily. In the end, here's the other thing I say in the Atlanta piece, he's actually a really good communicator. In other words, it doesn't have to be this way because Joe Biden is a very accessible human being. He has a word, I don't know if it's pure English, but it's used a lot, relatable. And he's relatable across the spectrum. We've talked about all the different demographic dynamics happening in American politics, but a voter who went from, for example, voting for Barack Obama to later on voting for Donald Trump, that's still a voter that Joe Biden can speak to. And he obviously can speak profoundly to the base of the Democratic Party. He can speak to progressives. His vision has been very progressive in many ways. I love his communications ability, but I want him to communicate a simpler, clearer vision than I've heard from him.
So give it a shot, if you would. Where is Biden taking us? Do you have some of the words for what he should be repeating consistently? Because you say, get a message out there and repeat it consistently to make people feel he's connected to them?
I don't pretend to have the exact words, but I'll give you examples. I think one of the areas where we can really, as Democrats, make a huge difference in people's lives is on healthcare and healthcare costs, which goes to two issues that are absolutely at the core of what people are going through right now. I mean, everything COVID and beyond, healthcare concerns are so deep in the American psyche, in American life right now. And then, of course, inflation. The Democrats right now can pass legislation to lower prescription drug costs and to lower the cost of insulin. The votes are there. I'm not saying it's easy to negotiate with Joe Manchin, but even Joe Manchin has said that's someplace he wants to go. I think Joe Biden saying, I'm going to lower your healthcare costs. I'm going to make it easier for you to get the healthcare you need. Simple as that. I think him saying on another very powerful issue, obviously so many of us are absolutely mortified by the Supreme Court draft in the Roe v. Wade case. Mm-hmm. That next morning, Joe Biden was on the tarmac before leaving to another part of the country, and reporters got an opportunity to speak to him. And what I wanted Joe Biden to do was be clear. He gave sort of a dissertation on the Supreme Court, on his efforts to stop Robert Bork decades ago, all sorts of things. But he never said this one simple sentence, the sentence I think millions of Americans, particularly millions of American women, needed to hear, which is, I will fight like hell to protect a woman's right to choose. I think that's what he needed to say. I think that's what he needs to repeat every chance he gets. So to some extent, I'm saying direction sharp, clear direction. He obviously has a kind of parenthetical, rambly way of speaking. He's had that for decades, by the way, even when he was a much younger man. But I think at this moment, with such confusion and instability and fear, my argument in the Atlantic piece is Joe Biden still has the number one bully pulpit on earth. And he's a good communicator, and he's a respected, decent human being. Turn that into those simple declarative messages that he can really back up with some action. Not perfect. He won't be able to solve every problem, but show people where he will take us. And I actually think even in this very pained, confusing moment in history, that single powerful voice still is the one that moves many, many people, including many people who have not made up their minds. This is last, just one last point on this, Brian. Mm-hmm. The end of the piece, I say, people want to have some hope again. They want to believe we can kind of come out of all this. And I said, let the voice of hope be the warm, positive voice of Joe Biden, because he is an optimistic person. He is a warm person. Let him talk about that rather than the minutia of government that seems to pervade his every pronouncement.
So listeners, you recognize the voice if you're just tuning in. Former Mayor Bill de Blasio, who does have a piece in The Atlantic, offering Joe Biden advice based on what the former mayor says were his own failures of communication in office that he thinks Biden is falling into the patterns of. So listeners, if you're a Democrat concerned with holding Congress this year, does Mayor de Blasio have the right idea about what Biden and the Washington leaders of the party are doing wrong? Or anything else you didn't get to ask Bill de Blasio during his 6 years of coming on the show every week? 212-433-WNYC.
That's a lot of subject matter, Brian.
That's right. Somebody out there has been left on hold 400 times.
That's right.
212-433-9692 or tweet at Brian Lehrer. This has been a problem for Democrats for a long time, hasn't it? I'm going to play a clip from 15 years ago that may or may not surprise you. Chuck Schumer came on the show for a book he wrote back in 2007. And you know what the title was? It was Positively American, Winning Back the Middle Class Majority, One Family at a Time. Winning back the middle class as something he felt the Democrats had lost even way back then. And one of the things he talked about from that book was that the Republicans were better at boiling down their policies to values-based slogans that you can say in eight words. So listen to this 30-second clip of Chuck Schumer here in 2007.
I say in 2004, Bush won with eight words. War in Iraq, cut taxes, no gay marriage. Now, each of those is a specific issue that, you know, Bush staked his political reputation on, tied to a deep value. War in Iraq, strong security, cut taxes, shrink government, no gay marriage, family values. And I asked the question, what are our eight words? Well, when you think about it, we're not close to it yet. This book is an attempt to get to our eight words, because in 2008, we need them. We're not going to have to just run on an anti-Bush platform.
Chuck Schumer here 15 years ago. That is so eerily reminiscent of this moment for me. You don't have Trump. The party doesn't have Trump to run against in 2022. So why is this a perennial problem for the Democratic Party?
Well, look, I agree. I think Chuck Schumer's summary is powerful. I would also remind all of us the 2004 election was winnable, and I think we were hindered in part, with all due respect to John Kerry, by some of his communications problems. Joe Biden doesn't have that problem. I want to note this. I'll answer your question, but I really want to note it. We have a leader who can connect with middle-class and working-class Americans more than we often have had, and that counts for a lot. I just wanted to do it. So, look, I think right now, I don't know if it's eight words, but I'll tell you, the right this minute, the rights of American women are being stolen before their very eyes. I think fighting for the rights of women, fighting for women's right to choose, right there, you talk about the eight words or three words or whatever the hell, right there is going to be one of the definitional elements of the 2022 midterm election, and that is a voting issue. That is an emotional, personal issue. Lower health care costs, you know, lower prescription drug costs. You know, these are really, here's the other one, Brian. You want something that polls through the roof, and not just among Democrats, even among independents and Republicans? Tax the corporations and the wealthy. Joe Biden actually has a plan, which even Manchin has been positive towards elements of, for higher taxes on corporations and billionaires, a place Republicans never can go. So it is a Democratic problem, but it's not for lack of subject matter. In the Atlantic piece, I talk about 2018. In 2018, Democrats running for Congress with shocking consistency and unity talked about health care, protecting affordable health care, because the Republican Party had been attacking Obamacare and Medicaid expansion. And so Democrats everywhere said, we're going to protect your health care. It was extraordinarily powerful and clear, and it was believable because no one thought the Republicans were going to protect their health care, and everyone believed the Democrats had thrown down on the topic of health care. So Chuck Schumer's formulation, I think, is right. That what pains me, Brian, is we never lack contrast with the Republicans, especially in the age of Trump, and we never lack subject matter. We lack simplicity and clarity, and it is a fixable problem. It's a fixable problem, and it's particularly fixable with a president who can communicate with empathy.
We did a call-in after that Schumer segment for Democrats. What are the eight words that they would have run on back then? That was 2007, before they knew Barack Obama was going to be the candidate in 2008 or anything. And maybe we should do it again after this segment with you, or during this segment with you. Listeners, what are the eight words in Chuck Schumer's terminology from 15 years ago that the Democrats should be running on, or any other response you have to what Bill de Blasio is saying here? I'll just, before we go to our first caller, I'll just say one thing about health care. Democrats don't bring it up very much, but they've won on Obamacare. Remember when the big issue, one of the biggest issues for the Republicans, was repeal and replace? And then when Trump was president, they actually tried to do it, and John McCain cast that tie-breaking vote when he was dying in the middle of the night and saved Obamacare. Well, they don't talk about repealing Obamacare anymore because it's gotten established as a popular thing, and even more so in the pandemic. So the Democrats won on that. We don't hear about it very much. And when you bring up prescription drug prices, you know, obviously that's taking a back seat now to other kinds of inflation, to Ukraine, to other things that are going on, crime. But is there something Biden could do by executive order that would lower prescription drug prices?
You know, I want to just challenge one piece there, Brian,
sure,
with real respect.
Sure.
I think one of the things I learned along the way in political life is if you can't do everything, do something. And I do think on the issues you just laid out, on prescription drug prices, I don't know enough about the executive order side of it, but I do know there's still a vote that could be won. From everything we've heard from the House and the Senate, and even from the very interesting reality of Joe Manchin, this is still a winnable issue.
Right, in Congress,
and it would make
so
it profound.
They can tout
in Congress
that as a win as they run in the midterms.
Correct, and maybe if you know there had been a less expansive approach to Build Back Better, this could have been done already. You know, who knows? That's Monday morning quarterback. But what we can say is that really does appear to still be a winnable issue, and it's a place where Republicans will not go because they will always be on the side of the pharmaceutical companies, not everyday Americans. And then when the other issues you raised on Ukraine, I think, which is a huge issue, but it's not so much a kitchen table issue, but Joe Biden has a whole lot to show there because he really has led the world. And, the polling in the last few days is showing more and more people connecting with that. I just wrote a piece, op-ed in Newsweek on this point, that I think people are starting to see our reality as Americans differently because we're actually leading in a productive way, helping an embattled people. On inflation, I think we all know that's going to be a tough one. It's supply chain, it's COVID, it's lots of things contributing to it. But I think then show people a bigger vision, even if it's not going to be not going to be resolved in this month. Put forward a simple plan of how we're going to overcome it over time. I found that people really pay attention if you present them an honest assessment. If you say, I'm not going to be able to solve this month, but we can do a lot better, you know, in the course of this year, we can do a lot better next year. He's done some of the right things already in terms of trying to rein in gas prices. But it's really, to me, it's about just incessantly talking about what people care about and making sure they know you care too. And I think sometimes my assessment of the Biden approach and message is, again, it goes right to sort of policy. It goes right to, you know, the mechanics of government. When I think what people want to hear is, I got you. I understand how much you're hurting. And this is what I'm going to do right now. And this is what I'm going to do that's going to solve some of the bigger problems. But to his credit, what he's done on COVID, what he's done on infrastructure, what he's done on Ukraine, he actually has a foundation to work from, which should not be underestimated. And that's a lot of what people will see when they judge the Democratic Party.
Pierre in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with former Mayor Bill de Blasio. Hello, Pierre.
Hi, thank you for letting me share my opinion.
Sure. What you got for us?
I just wanted to say I actually completely agree that I think Democrats are getting stuck in minutiae. And I think the one thing that was really great during COVID that former Mayor de Blasio said was that people were kind of mobilized. And now that we're kind of getting back to normal, ironically, when everyone was home and locked down and individually in their apartments, we were all mobilized. And now when we're getting back to normal, everyone's too busy to be mobilized. And I think people are feeling overwhelmed. And I think it's true. We need to have some very basic messaging. You know, people are still really terrified that they're losing their rights. And I think the last couple of weeks have really brought that home. And I had a diverse group of 12-year-old middle schoolers from District 15, by the way. And they were telling me yesterday during the protest that they were afraid that, you know, if this right erodes, everything else is going to follow. And I think, you know, the parents feel that way too. And I think if we can talk about, you know, Republicans aren't the only ones to own the argument of saving freedom and saving rights and being patriotic. And I think we need to kind of talk about that a little and invest in that a little. And I also agree with the prescription drugs. You know, when we're as parents having to get EpiPens that are, you know, $400 and they're required, you know, things like that are on your mind, whether or not you realize it. So I think a lot of folks are really feeling it in every generation. And so I think this is something that's in every party. So these are all really good points to kind of focus on. And I think it's really a good time for us to really delve into it right now while things are slowing down. I think taking advantage of the summer rather than thinking people are sleepy during it is actually going to help us.
That's a wonderful analysis, Pierre, and I really appreciate it. And I think this point you made about people being mobilized, that's a really interesting word choice. I think the president has a chance to sort of create that vision of mobilizing people for where America needs to go. And that means protecting rights, which I agree with you, is profoundly patriotic and sort of the essence of the American experience is protecting people's rights, and they are being stolen at this moment. But I also think it's mobilizing to, you know, put the country back together post-COVID. I think it's mobilizing against climate change. I think there is a chance for Biden still to pick up, you know, he obviously emulates FDR. He was literally, you know, born and raised in the aftermath of the New Deal, and it's in his bloodstream, you can tell. He has a chance here to say, this is what America could become. And I mentioned this other piece in Newsweek on Ukraine, because his leadership on Ukraine is actually the closest thing I have seen in decades to America in a good way, in a noble, democratic, small d, democratic way, leading the world and building an extraordinary coalition. And I think there is in that a sense of pride that it could regenerate. That idea of how about we create a country that we all start to feel much better about. Joe Biden's actually well positioned to offer that vision. But what I see him doing, and I looked over the last few weeks, and he did one event on internet affordability, then he did another event on the Javelin missiles for Ukraine, and he did another event on competition with China, and none of it fit together. There was no sense of where is this taking us. If he can shift, in my opinion, to that bigger vision of mobilizing us as a people for a common cause, he actually could tap into something.
We'll take a break. We'll continue with former Mayor Bill de Blasio. I'm going to read you a couple of tweets when we come back. Kim on Twitter writes that Kim has the eight words for the Democratic Party. I'll read that. Another Twitter user says, we're not buying it anymore. Democrats aren't delivering on promises. I'll tell you why he says that. We'll take some more phone calls, and we will talk about city stuff with Mayor de Blasio, too. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with former Mayor Bill de Blasio, his first appearance here since leaving office on the occasion of his Atlantic Magazine article. And we'll talk about his Newsweek article on Ukraine a little bit, too. Interesting how the Democrats and Republicans, at least some wings of the party, have kind of flipped on who doesn't want to get involved in foreign wars. But the main reason we invited him back on for today is his article in The Atlantic on mistakes he believes he made as mayor that he wants Joe Biden to avoid as president, though which he says Biden is now making, to help Democrats retain their congressional majorities in the midterm elections. A couple of tweets coming in. Listener Kim, eight words from Twitter, the eight words the Democratic Party should run on since the Republicans are good at running on eight-word slogans. Tax billionaires, health care for all, save the planet. Here's another tweet. Brian on Twitter writes, we're not buying it anymore. Democrats aren't delivering on promises. For example, supporting unions, but not funding the NLRB, or fully staffing NLRB offices. Biden meeting with Smalls, the Amazon union organizer, but giving Amazon a multi-billion-dollar contract. So, Mayor de Blasio, I think that's, you know, emblematic of a certain progressive wing of the Democratic Party that is alienated and may not help with the massive turnout in November.
Well, I think it's true that there are alienated progressives, and I think the Democratic Party has really missed the boat over the last 5-10 years, particularly, you know, from Occupy Wall Street on. I think it was so clear that there was a huge progressive impulse growing in this country, and the Democratic Party has not fully met it. That's a true statement. To that specific example, I mean, I would just challenge that, again, whatever one disagrees with, let's give the Democratic Party credit for the core achievements of the last year plus. I mean, a very strong, coherent effort to vaccinate the country and to create a stimulus to bring back the economy, which has worked very, very well. Despite whatever challenges, the economy is still overwhelmingly back. The fact that there's an infrastructure bill, which is something people talk about for decades, it's actually happened. The fact that we are leading the world in defending a country being invaded by an imperialist power. I mean, these are big, strong things. And so I would say, yeah, look, can Democrats do more to help organize labor? 100%, and we should. But I think this is not lack of achievement. I think we are not speaking to working people, and we're not making clear that we're on their side. Now, this is something, I was a Bernie Sanders supporter in 2020. This is something Bernie Sanders does so well. But I think Joe Biden could do it well. I think the rest of the Democrats could do it well. It's not just about, of course, substance matters here. but we're just not even saying the simple thing I used to talk about, working people first. That message needs to pervade everything we do.
Brian in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Brian. Thank you so much for having me on. Love your show. It's an honor to be speaking with former mayor. I first want to just begin by thanking both of you for having former Mayor de Blasio on your show every Friday. That meant a lot to me. I didn't know former Mayor de Blasio. I wasn't really familiar with him when he was elected. But hearing him on the show, having real New Yorkers call in, talking about real life problems, having the mayor be a human being and addressing those issues, sure, it was one at a time, but it made a difference in me getting to know this person and him being a presence in my life. I want Biden to hire a great social media team. He needs to be a presence in the everyday person's life. It seems like he only emerges at these events that former Mayor de Blasio just described. He disappears. Where is Kamala Harris? I know that they're doing great work. I believe in their work, but it's old school politics that they're playing. The cultural and media and public landscape has changed. They need to harness the power of social media. And look, Trump did it, I think, in a very divisive, violent way. I think that if Biden is a beacon of hope, which I believe he has the potential to be, he needs to hire some social media people and really embrace the power of social media to be a hopeful, positive force. So I just would love to talk about that and hear your thoughts.
Wow. To Brian Lehrer, you've got some really good feedback from the audience today, and to Brian calling in. I love what you said about this point about being a presence in our lives. I'm glad that when I was on this show, I could be that, and I wish I had done a lot more. Again, this is I'm in a period of reflection and recognizing things I could have done so much better. But I will tell you, you just said something very, very important. Joe Biden, I don't blame him. He's a creature of Washington. He was in the Senate when he was 29 years old, for God's sakes. These set piece press conferences, I think, are really bad for him. And when he's out with everyday Americans, he does an outstanding job. I mean, everyone knows legendarily when he's out amongst the people, his warmth comes out, his connection. That's hard to do when you're president as opposed to being a candidate, but you can do more of it. And I think, yes, they could do a lot more in social media, but I would also say just get away from the formal, stodgy press conferences and, you know, the addresses to the nation and be out in the communities of this country, empathizing with people and presenting them a vision, because he is thoroughly believable. This is a true compliment to Joe Biden. There's no lack of integrity and clarity about who he is and what he believes. It's almost like the form, the famous Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. I think the form of his communication is taking away his heart and soul.
Hmm.
And what Brian said calling in, that we need a presence in our life. If we needed a president to be an empathy in us and to give us hope, if we've ever needed it, we needed it in the Depression and World War II. Franklin Roosevelt did it nearly perfectly. We need it even more now than we needed then, because the level of confusion and the sense of things being adrift is like we've never had before. But it's amazing what one clear voice can do to cut through that.
Brian, thank you for your call. Let me ask you a question about your article in Newsweek, which was about something very different than we've been talking about war. And I think this one is also very interesting, and something I've been talking a little bit about here too, the fact that the war in Ukraine stands in contrast to pretty much every war the U.S. has fought since World War II, the good war, as the title of your piece has it. And I guess my maybe weird question is, where is the peace camp? Like, you were part of the peace camp in the 1980s when you were active in U.S. hands-off Central America. Now it's weirdly Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene, of all people, who say the $40 billion we're giving to Ukraine to fund the war will actually make things worse. More war, more death, while it could be getting used to ease the baby formula shortage in this country. is an example that she gives. Does that sound like something progressives would have said about Vietnam or the Contras or Iraq invading Kuwait once upon a time?
It's a great question. Let me say it real clearly. I wrote the piece in Newsweek, and I started talking about my dad, who lost half of one leg in Okinawa in the Battle of Okinawa, World War II. And the reason I started with that is to say I and my family, we knew a lot about the cost of war and how it stuck with our family for decades, but we never questioned that war. And I don't mean that like we were blind. No, I think we had our eyes very wide open because of the cost our family paid and my dad paid. But he believed to his dying day he had done the right thing to participate, and we believed he had done a good and noble thing because it was a battle against Nazism and fascism, et cetera. As you said, the wars since that America's been in have too often been imperialistic wars or wars without justification, or we were lied to by our own government. But now we have something very different. This is almost the flip. The imperialists are the Russians, obviously. They invaded a peaceful democratic country. And in a world where democracy is under threat, in a way that's very reminiscent of the 1930s, here is a thoroughgoing democratic country, Ukraine, and watching people killed who are just trying to lead their lives in a way that we can very personally relate to. I actually think from a progressive perspective, it's right to defend democratic Ukraine. In my family, there is a story. I heard it from my dad's sister that my dad wanted to go volunteer for the Spanish Civil War and tried to go off as a college student to fight in Spain against Francisco Franco and the fascists. And his family went to the Stamford, Connecticut train station and pulled him off the platform, basically, and wouldn't let him go. And I say that because that was actually the pivot point of history. The Spanish Civil War was the moment where fascism and Nazism could have been stopped. And the West looked the other way. And this time, the democratic nations are not looking the other way. And so I think what's happening now really rejuggles, even for all of us who are progressives, it rejuggles our understanding of things. But I also think it's going to affect the American psyche. This is the thesis of my Newsweek op-ed, that we're actually leading again, and we're leading for a noble cause, and the world is listening to us, and we have something to be proud of. And that is part of our historic identity. Whether it was always, you know, the whole truth or not, a lot of the American identity was leader of the world. It doesn't have to be an imperialistic version. It can be a more noble version. It could be a defense of real democracy. But I do think there's a possibility this is going to affect our deeper psyche as well as our politics. If people continue to see our country doing something that actually is across party lines regarded as noble and honorable.
Interesting. All right, we have a few minutes left. Let me get your quick take on a few city things. I'm sure you don't want to grandstand over Mayor Adams, especially this early on, but on a couple of specifics. One, do you think he's reversing the progress you made on criminal justice reform with some of his law enforcement policies?
Well, look, first of all, I have a lot of respect for Mayor Adams, and I've talked to him a lot about a wide range of issues. And I think everyone needs to recognize that the first months of being mayor are so challenging. It's such a new reality. I think if you listen to his history and his vision, he very much believes in reform. You know, obviously there's individual issues we could agree or disagree on, but I think people need to give this some time to play out. We're dealing with a very particular COVID-fueled crime crisis. It will be for a period of time, but it's, Lord knows, not going to be forever. But a guy who spent his whole life fighting for police reform, I think that counts for a lot.
He did reverse a specific policy that you had announced late in your second term on ending gifted and talented programs in the lower grades. Are you unhappy about that?
Look, I, first of all, respect, really, really respect the fact that we have mayoral accountability for education and we need it going forward. It's the only way our school system can continue to progress. I think there should be a broader reevaluation of gifted and talented. What the plan we put forward, and again, I'm going to say this in the spirit of self-criticism. We struggled to find a plan that would work for a very different vision. I actually think we got there at the end, but it was much later than it should have been in a perfect world. If we had just done a better job figuring it out earlier, but it literally took us all that time to figure out something that would work. I think what we presented in 2021, which is really ending the narrow version of gifted and talented, making it something where we tap into the tens of thousands of kids each year who have gifts, not just a few thousand. I think that's the way of the future. But I understand we presented that plan late, and for something like that to work, I think it's going to take real time to develop.
And last one, do you think he's reversing the progress you made on COVID through your vaccine mandates? You were a national leader on that. He ended the mandate for restaurants and clubs, gyms. We have an uptick right now, the biggest since January. And the big announcement from City Hall this week is that they're lifting the vaccine mandate for high school proms.
Well, no, I'm going to say this. I think we're in a very different moment on COVID than even where I was, you know, 5-6 months ago. What I would say is essential is to keep every mandate available at all times, meaning, you know, if COVID has thrown us so many curveballs, and anyone thinks they understand COVID, you know, they got another thing coming. So I'm not going to criticize him. He knows the latest, his health team knows the latest information in ways I don't, but I'd say this as a friendly reminder. Keep those strong tools available. You may need them real soon. Thank you for what you said, that yes, New York City did lead the nation on vaccine mandates, and thank God we did, because it helped us save a lot of lives, but also helped us bring our city back. I don't think they're going to be needed the way they used to be, but we don't know that yet. They have to be held in reserve just because this is so unpredictable.
And in fairness to him, he does say that too. He is holding these in reserve to reimpose if he thinks the time comes. So on your way out the door, Mr. Mayor, what should we make of the fact that these articles you're publishing are about national and international affairs and not New York City? Does it say something about where you think your future lies?
Well, it's to me really important to speak to these issues, because I think right now, I mean, as much as what's happening in New York City is for me my first love, and so much that, you know, is pressing, we're in a moment that's so hard to describe. The challenges facing this country and this world are so profound, and we are so rudderless compared to what we've seen in the past. That's what I feel called to speak about. And the good news is I think you'll see in these two pieces in The Atlantic and Newsweek, I mean, there's an optimism I really feel in my heart. It's a very tough time. It's a very disorienting time. But I still think there's a tremendous possibility for coming out of this in a better place. I just feel called to talk about that, and I hope it contributes something.
Well, it's great to have you back again, and I'm sure it won't be the last time. So thank you as always.
I enjoy these times together, Brian, and thank you, as I told you my last time back in December, thank you for giving New Yorkers this dialogue, you know, on so many topics. It's really cherished out there. I can tell you, people say to me all the time that your show means a hell of a lot to them.